for more. We know who the most recent war criminals are. Coming others: George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, General Ricardo Sanchez, former CIA Director George Tenet, former Assistant Attorney General J. Bybee, former Department Assistant Attorney General John Yoo, who set up the legal framework to authorize torture, the helicopter pilots who gunned down civilians, including two Reuters journalists in the collateral murder video released by WikiLeaks. We have evidence of the crimes they committed. Julian Assange, even though he is not a U.S. citizen and his WikiLeaks site is not a U.S.-based publication, is charged under the U.S. Espionage Act for making public numerous war crimes. Assange, currently housed in a high-security prison in London, is fighting a losing battle in the British courts to block his extradition to the United States, where he faces 175 years in prison. We must demand justice for those who were wounded, became sick, or died because the United States destroyed hospitals and infrastructure. We must demand justice for the 38 million people who have been displaced or become refugees in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, the Philippines, Libya, and Syria, a number that exceeds the total of all those displaced in all wars since 1900. Apart from the Second World War, according to the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. Every effort to hold American war criminals accountable has been rebuffed by Congress, by the courts, by the media, and by two ruling political parties. The Center for Constitutional Rights blocked by bringing cases in the U.S. courts against the architects of these preemptive wars, which are defined by post-Nuremberg laws as criminal wars of aggression, filed motions in German courts to hold U.S. leaders to account for gross violations of the Geneva Convention, including the sanctioning of torture in black sites such as Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. Why weren't sanctions imposed on the United States of America? Why weren't those who defended their countries from foreign invasion in the West Asia, North Africa region, including Palestinians under Israeli regime occupation, also provided with thousands of anti-tank weapons, anti-armor weapons, anti-aircraft weapons, helicopters, switchblade or kamikaze drones, hundreds of Stinger anti-aircraft systems, javelin anti-tank missiles, machine guns, and millions of rounds of ammunition? Well, we know why. U.S. war crimes don't count, and neither do the victims for the U.S. war crimes. And this hypocrisy makes a rules-based world, one that abides by international law, impossible. This hypocrisy is not new. Mass death and fireballs on a city skyline are the calling cards Americans have left across the globe for decades. The deliberate targeting of civilians, whether in Baghdad, Gaza, or New York City, are all American war crimes. So is the killing of 230,000 people over the past 7 years in Yemen, from Saudi bombing campaigns and blockades that have resulted in mass starvation and cholera epidemics. Where were the calls for a no-fly zone over Gaza and Yemen? Imagine how many lives could have been saved. War crimes demand the same moral judgment and accountability, but they don't get them. And they don't get them because Americans have one set of standards for white Europeans and another for non-white people around the globe. The Second World War began with an understanding, at least by the Allies, that employing industrial weapons against civilian populations was a war crime. But within 18 months of the start of the war, the Germans, Americans, and British were relentlessly bombing cities. By the end of the war, one-fifth of German homes had been destroyed. 1 million German civilians were killed or wounded in bombing raids. 7.5 million Germans were made homeless. The tactic of saturation bombing or area bombing, which included the firebombing of Dresden, Hamburg, and Tokyo, which killed more than 90,000 Japanese civilians in Tokyo and left 1 million people homeless, and the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which took the lives of between 129,000 and 226,000 people, most of whom were civilians, and the sole purpose of breaking the morale of the population through mass death and terror. It turned the architects of modern war, all of them, into war criminals. Civilians in every war since have been considered legitimate targets. In the summer of 1965, then-Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara called the bombing raids north of Saigon that left hundreds of thousands of dead an effective means of communication with the government in Hanoi. McNamara, 6 years before he died, unlike most war criminals, had the capacity for self-reflection. Interviewed in the documentary The Fog of War, he was repentant, not only about targeting Vietnamese civilians, but about the aerial targeting of civilians in Japan in the Second World War, overseen by Air Force General Curtis LeMay. LeMay said, if we'd lost the war, we'd all have been prosecuted as war criminals, McNamara said in the film, adding, and I think he's right. LeMay recognized that what he was doing would be thought immoral if his side had lost. But what makes it immoral if you lose and not immoral if you win? Industrial killing defines modern warfare. It is impersonal mass slaughter. It is administered by vast bureaucratic structures that perpetuate the killing over months and years. It is sustained by heavy industry that produces a steady flow of weapons, munitions, tanks, planes, helicopters, battleships, submarines, missiles, and mass-produced supplies, along with mechanized transports that ferry troops and armaments by rail, ship, cargo planes, and trucks to the battlefield. It mobilizes industrial, governmental, and organizational structures for total war. It centralizes systems of information and internal control. It is rationalized for the public by specialists and experts drawn from the military establishment, along with pliant academics and the media. Industrial war destroys existing value systems that protect and nurture life, replacing them with fear, hatred, and dehumanization of those who are made to believe deserve to be exterminated. It is driven by emotions, not truth or fact. It obliterates nuisance, replacing it with an infantile binary universe of Americans and them. It drives competing narratives, ideas, and values underground and vilifies all who do not speak in the national cant that replaces civil discourse and debate. It is touted as an example of the inevitable march of human progress, when in fact it brings Americans closer and closer to mass obliteration and nuclear catastrophe. It mocks the concept of individual heroism despite the feverish efforts of the military and the mass media to sell this myth, this legend, to naive young recruits and a gullible public. Of course, there will be no prosecution of Saudi Arabian rulers for the war crimes committed in Yemen or for the U.S. military and political leadership for the war crimes they carried out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, or a generation earlier in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The atrocities Americans commit, such as My Lai, where 500 unarmed Vietnamese civilians were gunned down by U.S. troops, which are made public, are dealt with by finding a scapegoat, usually a low-ranking officer who is given a symbolic sentence. Lieutenant William Kelly served 3 years under house arrest for the killing of At My Lai. 11 U.S. troops, none of whom were officers, were convicted of torture at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. But the architects and the overlords of U.S. industrial slaughter, including Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill, General Curtis LeMay, Harry S. Truman, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger, Lyndon Johnson, General William Westmoreland, George W. Bush, General David Petraeus, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden are never held to account. They leave power to become venerated elder statesmen. The mass slaughter of industrial warfare, the failure to hold Americans to account, to see American face in the war criminals they condemn, will have ominous consequences. Politicians and generals wield their destructive fury as if they were toys. Those who decry the madness, who demand the rule of law, are attacked and condemned. These industrial weapon systems are U.S. modern idols. Communique.
Jean-Luc Brunel, a famous French model scout and fashion industry figure, has been found dead in his prison cell in what appears to be a suicide. Brunel was a close associate of infamous billionaire and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, who is also supposed to have hung himself in his cell. We've heard about Epstein and the sex trafficking and the victims who've come forward, but why has the media said nothing about the blackmailing aspect? That Epstein and his close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, were using underage girls to gather dirt on politicians so they could blackmail them? And what about the relationship to Israel's intelligence service, the Mossad? Today, we're going to try and answer these questions and look at the saga a little more carefully. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On Saturday, February 19th, 2022, Jean-Luc Brunel, a prominent French model scout, was found dead in his cell in La Santé prison in what has been called a suicide. Now you might be wondering, why should this be of any particular interest? Because Brunel was not just a big figure in the fashion industry, he was also a close associate of billionaire sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Brunel stands accused of sexual assault and having partaken in an alleged sex trafficking ring run by Epstein. To be frank, he was providing young girls to Epstein for sex. And for lack of a better word, he was a pimp. Now, according to one of the victims, Virginia Gouffray, Epstein admitted to her that he had, quote, slept with over 1,000 of Brunel's girls. And it was from Virginia Gouffray's civil suit against Epstein's close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, that we know of Brunel's name as well. And this is one day that we see these court documents unsealed, one day before Jeffrey Epstein's death. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was known for living a lavish life and always inviting very prominent figures like actors and high-level politicians and businessmen to fly around with him on his private jet. And so Jeffrey Epstein would go and invite these people to his private islands, right, where they would have intercourse with underage girls that he had trafficked through his associates such as Maxwell or Brunel, who were running these fashion and model agencies where they would get these girls from. And so following the revelations of this scandal, you know, people are starting to wonder, are these prominent figures, the politicians, the actors, all of these people we see in the photographs with Epstein, did they also participate in this sex trafficking ring? Because many of their names appear on the flight logs of Jeffrey Epstein's private jets. One of those names is, of course, Jean-Luc Brunel. The flight logs list him as a passenger 25 times on Epstein's private plane. And so who exactly was Jeffrey Epstein, the real Jeffrey Epstein? And why are there so many secrets surrounding this whole case? Now, back in 2008, Epstein pleaded guilty for soliciting a minor for prostitution. He served 13 months in jail, but unlike most prisoners who have to stay in prison, Epstein was given the luxury of being able to work out of his office 6 days a week. Now, one of the women who has come forward to accuse Epstein of sexual assault is Maria Farmer. When Maria Farmer was just a young art student, Epstein bought one of her paintings. She was recruited to work as his art advisor. And Farmer claims that Epstein showed her an entire system of secret video surveillance that he had set up inside his property with cameras in the bedrooms and the toilets. Now, Farmer was the first victim to officially report Epstein's behavior and abuse to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI. However, at the time, you know, the authorities just didn't seem to take her accusations seriously, and there was no investigation. When Ghislaine Maxwell found out that Farmer had paid a visit to the FBI, she began threatening her with physical violence.
What sort of threats has she made against you?
Originally, it started with things like, I'm going to burn your art, and then I'm going to burn your career, and then I'm going to burn you and the house you live in. And then it was, oh, be careful crossing a street. You know, you can get shot in the back of the head. You know, they were threats against my life, and I told the FBI this.
It wasn't just Maxwell, Brunel, and Epstein doing this. The victims have also accused many high-level officials, billionaires, professors, even the British royal family, Prince Andrew, of having partaken in this sex trafficking. Epstein provided them with young girls, which they abused. Now, earlier, I talked about the flight logs and how Brunel's name appears there. But you might be more familiar with former U.S. President Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, whose names appear multiple times on Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was finally arrested on July 6, 2019, on federal charges for sex trafficking minors, and he pleaded not guilty. They then put Epstein in New York City's Metropolitan Correctional Center, also known as MCC, and they put him on suicide watch because he reportedly tried to take his own life. Now, when you're put under suicide watch, that means you're under 24/7 surveillance. But after an assessment by a high-level psychologist, Epstein was taken out of suicide watch, and they put him instead in a special housing unit, or an SHU. And so barely a month after his arrest, on August 10th at 6:30 a.m., Jeffrey Epstein is found dead in his cell by apparent suicide. And it turns out that the guards had fallen asleep and there's no camera footage. And with Brunel's suicide, the same thing. There's no camera footage. The cameras were not working. Now, look, there are many theories floating out there about Epstein's death, specifically because a lot of things don't add up. And even then, Attorney General William Barr, he himself admitted to some, quote, serious irregularities. There are also numerous suicide prevention experts who also expressed serious concern. Senior staff counsel with the National Prison Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, Eric Balaban, raised questions as to why Epstein's life was risked by putting him in this restrictive special housing unit, or SHU, specifically when he had shown suicidal tendencies. According to him, an SHU is just not an appropriate thing for someone who's shown recent suicidal tendencies. Now, I can recall as I was attending the extradition hearing of Julian Assange, one of the people testifying was none other than Maureen Baird, Maureen Baird is the former warden of that very prison, MCC, where Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. And she spoke about the prison conditions there, specifically about pretrial SAMs. However, she did note one thing, that Jeffrey Epstein was the first person to kill themselves at MCC since 2013. Now, to be honest, I cannot know how, you know, for sure how Jeffrey Epstein died, whether he simply decided to end his life because of all the pressure from the trial and the public exposure and the lengthy sentence awaiting him, or whether he was killed because he was too dangerous and the elites wanted to tie up some loose ends. But let me tell you something that we can verify. This wasn't the first time Jeffrey Epstein was in jail. As we were saying earlier, he was arrested in 2007. But how come he got off so easily? Well, it turns out that Alexander Acosta was the Miami Attorney General at the time. And while he was being interviewed a couple of years later for the position of Labor Secretary by Donald Trump's transition team, Acosta revealed that, quote, "I was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone." And now you see why he cut Jeffrey Epstein a non-prosecution plea deal. If all of this wasn't enough, you know, all of this horrible sex trafficking, it also seems that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and Jean-Luc Brunel had ties to at least Israeli intelligence, if not also American intelligence. You know, Epstein had been known to brag about working for the Mossad, and Acosta just gives him a slap on the wrist because he knows that he's working with intelligence. Now, Epstein's longtime partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, her father, Robert Maxwell, is known to have been both a KGB and Mossad agent. You see, Robert Maxwell was a very, very famous media tycoon who owned 6 national newspapers in the UK. He also famously stole around £500 million from his own workers' pension funds. Now, journalist Whitney Webb, who's done fantastic work on Epstein, she's written extensively about Robert Maxwell's exploits as a Mossad agent in great detail. At one point, for example, Robert Maxwell acquired a company called Information on Demand, which was a front. It was a cutout for the Mossad. And they sold an Israeli piece of software called Promise, right? And this software was sold to governments around the world. And it had a back door inside it, allowing the Israelis to penetrate and spy on the very clients they had sold it to. So Robert Maxwell even sold Promise, this software, to a Los Angeles-based firm called Sandia National Laboratories, which provided Israeli intelligence with direct access to the core of the U.S. nuclear weapons program and nuclear weapons technology. And speaking of nuclear technology, it's also believed that Robert Maxwell is the one who tipped off the Israeli embassy in London about the Israeli nuclear scientist Mordechai Vanunu, after Vanunu had divulged the existence of Israel's nuclear program to the press. Right? Vanunu was subsequently kidnapped in Rome. They flew him to Israel and then sentenced him to almost 2 decades in prison. And when the issue of Robert Maxwell being a Mossad spy was brought up, because you have to keep in mind, he was also a member of parliament in the UK, so this was quite the scandal. And when this was brought up, no one would print it because the press feared being hit with a libel suit, right? So instead, what happened is George Galloway and Rupert Allison, who were both MPs at the time, they went and raised this issue in the House of Commons, exposing Robert Maxwell as a Mossad spy. And by extension, this allowed the British press to start printing about it without fear of reprisal or fear of being sued by Maxwell and his lawyers. And just a few weeks later, mysteriously, Maxwell died after allegedly falling off of his yacht. He was buried with full honors at the Mount of Olives. And you know who attended his funeral? The Israeli Prime Minister and President and at least 6 former and serving heads of the Mossad. Maybe that will give you an idea about how important he was for the Israelis, that all of these figures are attending his funeral. And so that's Ghislaine Maxwell's father, right? But if you thought the only connection here to the Mossad was her father, well, you'd better think again. Journalist Jeff Shalev conducted an interview in 2019 with an individual named Ari Ben Menashe. Ben Menashe was a, quote, Israeli consultant and former arms dealer who also served as a senior executive for Israel's Directorate of Military Intelligence from 1977 to 1987. So this puts Ben Menashe in a unique position to divulge about Epstein and also Maxwell, because he met them both 40 years ago when he was working for Israel alongside Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell. And so in this interview, Ben Menashe is asked, quote, "You spoke about Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell as being part of Israeli military intelligence. Do you know specifically which unit?" Ben Menashe replies that, quote, "Because of Robert Maxwell, they worked directly with military intelligence. I don't know who they answer to." The interviewer then continues, "Would you say that she was an agent as well and in military intelligence as well?" Ben Menashe says yes, yes to both. And so Ben Menashe also makes another thing very clear, that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, the entire point of their sex trafficking operation was to, quote, "blackmail American and other political figures by specifically seeking out underage girls for their friends." And as for Jean-Luc Brunel, he used his modeling agency to traffic girls to Epstein, right? And unsurprisingly, he had an office in where? Tel Aviv, right? An office in Tel Aviv as part of his modeling agency with Epstein. And so here in this picture, you can see Brunel wearing a cap that reads Israeli Army. Again, that's perhaps not the most incriminating thing, but do keep it in mind. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Graham Elwood. He's an American comedian, podcaster, and writer. He hosts a progressive YouTube show and podcast called The Political Vigilante. He's also the co-host of Government Secrets with Lee Camp. Graham has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for several years now, which even resulted in his YouTube channel being demonetized. Graham, could you maybe just to start off give us a very brief overview of the Epstein case in the simplest terms so anyone can get it?
I have a whole Epstein playlist on my YouTube channel, and one of the most critical interviews I would ask people to watch is where I interview a former child crimes investigator, my friend Eric Oldenburg, who was on the Phoenix Police Department for 24 years, and he investigated online basically child trafficking and child pornography and and pretty gnarly stuff. And I mean, he said, you know, anyone can be a pedophile, any socioeconomic status, any ethnicity, any gender, any sexual orientation. Sexual orientation doesn't even necessarily correlate. He said, but the people that can get away with it the most are the wealthy and most powerful. And that's what the Epstein case is. You want to understand how the ruling elites operate? Start paying attention to the Epstein case, because you've got, in the intelligence community, specifically CIA and Mossad, are their handprints are all over this. And, you know, like with these examples, just some basic stuff. So when Epstein was arrested in West Palm Beach, Florida in 2008, 2009 in that area, Acosta was the prosecutor, and he was told to... Epstein was a CIA asset and to back off. And that's why he gave him a very lenient case, charge. Basically, he got to leave his prison every day and fly around and literally traffic and abuse girls.
And when you mention powerful people and the ruling elites, you know, you have a lot of pictures, photographs of celebrities and very rich and important personalities that have photographed with Epstein or Maxwell. And we've also heard of this black book full of names. Could you basically tell us what that is and why we see so many important people photographed with Epstein and you know, people related, people in his entourage?
One of the things, and this has been confirmed in other places, one of the things Epstein would do, he'd have these parties with the wealthiest, most powerful people in the world. Billionaires, politicians, I mean, presidents, several different royal families, including the Saudis and the British royal family. And so this powerful person would come in. One of Epstein's butlers would say, hey, would you like a massage from a beautiful young woman? The guy would say yes. And it would be, they'd have sex and it would be a child. And they'd videotape it. Then Epstein would say, well, now I've got evidence of you having sex with a child. And they would then invest in Epstein's. He had some like fake hedge fund. So this is one of the ways Epstein got power. And this is why the intelligence community went, oh, this is an asset, because now we can use these videotapes as leverage. So what is so significant here, Richard, is when Epstein was arrested in July of 2019, we saw the video and the footage of the guys in the FBI coats dragging out, you know, not dragging, but like wheeling out on dolly trucks, boxes of photos, videos, hard drives, all this stuff. None of it. We have seen any of it. So what we have seen is just these little snippets. We've seen like the photos you've seen online. We've seen the flight logs. And I think the flight logs are very critical as well. They show stuff like Bill Clinton on his plane 26 times, Hillary on his plane two times. Trump was originally thought to only be on one time, but more flight logs were released at the end of December during the Maxwell trial, showing Trump was actually on five times. So to your question here, where is that information? Well, that is the reason why this stuff is getting swept under the rug, because the richest, most powerful people are on video. So that's why Jean-Luc Brunel is dead, is because he probably wouldn't play ball or had information or threatened to make a deal with the prosecutor saying, I'll give you these videotapes, give me a lighter sentence. And then all of a sudden, oh, wow, he's so distraught, he's going to hang himself. It's believed that Maxwell has so much information, and she's ruthless. She plays hardball, that she has, you know, I don't know, some people will call it like whatever you are, like a kill switch, basically. My belief is, Ghislaine Maxwell said, if I go down, you
sorry
go
to cut
down.
You off. I was going to ask you about the Maxwell trial, about Ghislaine Maxwell. I mean, how does she tie into Epstein? What's the relationship, and why is she so important to this case? And what did you make of the trial that took place a few months ago?
We'll call her socialite, Epstein's gal pal, maybe even a recruiter. But according to several Epstein victims, including Virginia Roberts Giuffre and Maria Farmer and Maria Farmer's sister, Annie Farmer, she participated. So she's a pedophile. Like, let's be real clear here. And the media will not call Ghislaine Maxwell a pedophile. She is a pedophile and a sex trafficker. And all the women that survived said Maxwell treated them horribly. She treated them like trash.
Well, I mean, speaking of these political connections, one thing that I was really interested in asking you is that, you know, the connections to the Mossad, because you mentioned it briefly at the beginning. If I recall correctly, Brunel, he had one of these modeling agency offices in Tel Aviv, right? And we've heard many times that Maxwell is connected to the Mossad. Could you explain what that connection is and how this relates to the intelligence, specifically U.S. and Israeli?
Maxwell's father was a Mossad agent, and he had a mysterious death, jumped off a boat or some very sort of odd, mysterious death. So you have that. Then you have, as I stated earlier, Acosta said at an interview in 2009 that he was told to go easy on the prosecution of Epstein in Florida because he was this is Acosta's words, not mine, a quote CIA asset. Right. And then you have, again, John Kiriakou said this in my interview with him, and I asked him about the CIA. I said, does the CIA condone getting children for pedophiles? He goes, no, but if you went, I'm going to get a child for this pedophile because if I get him children, then we can leverage that and use him as an asset. The CIA would go, okay, because they just want the leverage and the intel. And then seeing how, again, going back to Epstein's like fake hedge fund, these guys would donate money to it. And I'm blanking on the names. There was another big hedge fund guy. I can't keep track of all their names, but he donated or invested a lot of money with Epstein. And then women have spoken out against him. So what intelligence is doing, they needed people like Epstein to help them get leverage on all of these people. And they were like, look, Epstein, we'll let him have, you know, do whatever he wants on his plane and on his island, as long as he keeps feeding us intel. Until he kept getting, I think Epstein was one of these guys that was so egregious with it that then he became a problem and they got rid of him. From the intelligence standpoint, if they've got video of somebody or some evidence, then that person's easy to control. If that person is found guilty and goes to prison, they don't have them. They don't have, that person has no more power. They have no more leverage. So they need these key people to get all this stuff done. And they've got, you know, leverage on, you know, the Saudi royal family. They've got, and, you know, as I said, John Kiriakou said, this feels like the Israelis. He felt like Mossad, his first gut instinct as a former CIA operative was that Mossad was involved in Epstein's death. This all feels very coordinated and maneuvered by those two intelligence agencies.
There is one really important aspect, though, that the victims themselves have underscored, which is that Jeffrey Epstein used these girls to blackmail powerful people. And so, yes, Epstein and Ghislaine are very obviously depraved individuals who preyed on others. But they also did this to get dirt on the wealthy, on politicians, on businessmen, and anyone that mattered. And they did this in service of Israeli intelligence. They did this at the behest of the Mossad. And again, that's not only speculation. This is now confirmed. It's on the record, confirmed by former Israeli intelligence officials, as we were just going through. And so in addition to all of the already vile, deplorable sexual assaults that this entire saga is mired with, we can see now that there is very clearly a political dimension to it as well. And the fact that the media won't talk about this and never tackle this angle, it really speaks volumes, right? Why do they refuse to talk about this? And how come, despite unsealing so many documents, the courts still continue to keep many of them under wraps? What are they hiding from us exactly? And what could be the other dark secrets in the spy world that we're yet to discover? Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In lockstep with the spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
In the limelight.
When the last American troop fled, the U.S. regime immediately froze $10 billion of Afghan sovereign funds, says Brecht Jonkers, journalist, in an article published under the heading Continuing War Against the Afghan People by Starvation. Here's the story. Two decades of occupation and invasion by the world's foremost arrogant and hegemonic power came to an ignominious and inglorious end in 2021. Ever since the attacks on New York and Washington, D.C. in September 21, that had little to do with Afghanistan. Millions of Afghans have been punished for a crime they did not commit. By indulging in mass murder, ethnic cleansing, sexual violence, and the promotion of drug use, hundreds of thousands of Afghans died under horrible circumstances, and many millions more were subjected to indescribable cruelty. But even after the humiliating defeat inflicted on U.S.-led coalition forces in the longest war in U.S. history, the suffering of the Afghan people has not ended. When the last American troop fled with his tail between his legs, the U.S. regime immediately froze $10 billion of Afghan sovereign funds. Apparently, over 200,000 Afghan deaths were not enough to satiate the bloodlust of the imperialist cabal in Washington. This next step was in reality daylight robbery of the urgently needed money of what was already one of the poorest countries in the world. To say that every dime counts for the Afghan people is an underestimate. According to UN estimates, the after-effects of 2 decades of constant war and occupation combined with current heavy sanctions against the Afghan people have left some 55% of all Afghans facing extreme hunger. That is 23 million innocent men, women and children who face the specter of death by starvation every single day. The U.S. stopped almost all foreign aid to the West Asian country, followed swiftly by EU, IMF and the World Bank. The result was that by the end of war, up to 80% of Afghanistan's annual income came exclusively from foreign aid. In a mind-boggling show of truly heartless immorality combined with despicable propaganda, U.S. President Joe Biden announced on February 11th to withdraw, read it, steal billions of Afghan central bank funds and siphon them for financial support for victims of 9/11 attacks. Indeed, Afghan money is taken away from war victims, widows and orphans in Afghanistan to be given to victims and survivors of a terrorist attack with which the Afghans had absolutely nothing to do. This financial attack against Kabul serves triple purpose. First, it continues the empire's war against the people of Afghanistan by plunging them further into famine and poverty without the U.S. needing to fire a single shot. Second, it creates easily accessible funds for the Democrats to donate to victims of terrorism in the United States, thereby funding their look at how much better than Trump VR agenda without actually needing to use America's own rapidly dwindling financial assets. And third, and most perversely, it plays on the subconscious and completely unjustified mental connection many people still make between 9/11 and Afghanistan. One of the most influential and yet somehow most hidden away lies that the imperial war machine has been drilling into the public's mind is that the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan was justified in the name of counter-terrorism. The pointlessness of continuing what was, after all, the longest war in U.S. history by economic means has become clear even to some in the very halls of Washington, D.C. 40 House Democrats urged Biden in December to unfreeze Afghan financial assets and relax economic restrictions on Afghanistan. Maintaining this policy could cause more civilian deaths in the coming year than were lost in 20 years of war, the lawmakers wrote in their message to Biden. This calls to mind an analogy with the terrible consequences of Western economic sanctions on Syria, which has already led to a situation in which many people are suffering worse than during the period of actual military conflict. Britain's former Defense Chief General Sir David Richards echoed these sentiments with a surprisingly clear admission of his country's failure, saying, "I think this is the occasion for us to be magnanimous in defeat," Richards said. Former Afghan general Samer Sadat added that the Americans were strategically defeated in Afghanistan. They have to accept this defeat because the government that was the result of the 20-year presence of NATO and the U.S. collapsed in front of Americans' eyes. Deeply ingrained feelings of superiority and Western supremacy are, apparently, hard to let go even when faced with mountains of evidence to the contrary.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met Heather, Josh, and Rachel. All three suffer from disability and chronic illnesses. All three are children to fathers who fought in Vietnam, and all three are victims of Agent Orange. And now they've decided to embark on a journey to return to the country where their tragic story began as children of war veterans and as victims of war. Now stay with us to witness the rest of this emotional and healing journey.
My father lost his arm before he chose to have children. He lost his arm during the war. And then it took him 7 years to cope with that and feel that maybe he was mentally able to help raise a child.
The things that he had seen, he would always have flashbacks, and he suffered from PTSD really bad from all the things that he did and saw while he was in the war. And he was very abusive and he was very violent. And he would black out at times and think that he was still in the war. And there was times like we would get up in the middle of the night, me and my brother, and we would try to get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and he would be like hiding under our beds and grab our feet and pull us under the beds. And I mean, he had PTSD really bad.
He suffered flashbacks. Lots of flashbacks. Many nights he'd wake up moaning and groaning, screaming and yelling in his sleep.
They would put him in the helicopters and stuff, and they'd fly him all over and drop him off in the jungle, and they would get out of the helicopters, and the helicopters would leave him out there, and there would only be like maybe 30 guys. They were hiding everywhere, and he couldn't really run through the jungle because everything was booby-trapped, and there was pits with the spikes in them, and landmines everywhere and trip wires, and they had these big logs that had a bunch of bamboo spikes on them, and they'd put them up in the trees. So when you'd walk by and you'd trip a stick or whatever, it would fall down out of the tree and impale people. And there was, he said there was times that while they were on the battlefield that he would have to go and like his friend would be walking right in front of him, and he would step on a landmine and pieces of his friend would fly all over him, and he would have to pick up the pieces and put them in his backpack and carry them out.
He spent a lot of time by himself, very quiet. We were raised with war decor in our home, lots of Vietnam memorabilia, pictures and videos, books, that sort of thing. So it was always around us, and we always knew what had happened to our father. We never knew him any other way, so we always knew what had happened to him.
He just couldn't take it anymore. He tried to drink the pain away. He tried to work it away. He tried to tell me and my brother everything that he went through. He tried talking about it. He tried everything. And when he first got there and everything, he was just out of high school, and what he encountered when he got over there was not what he expected at all. One of the missions that he had got sent on when he first got here was that they went into a village, and the whole time I've been here, I've been trying to ask people and everything, and the other day, we were at another VAVA office, and we were there with the general, and when he started to open the book, it was mentioned that my father was in Chu Lai. Everybody that was in there said, oh, Chu Lai. And it kind of made me start to think, well, what went on in Chu Lai that was so bad that everybody knows about it? And he was explaining all that. But then when he found Chu Lai on the map, he pointed at it and he cried and shut the book and pushed it away from him. And that really hit home, because that's where my dad was at. And then when we got to the museum and I found where his company and everything was at, and I saw it on the wall, and then I saw where they slaughtered all them women and children. And my dad was only 19 years old when he joined the military, when he came to Vietnam. So at 19 years old, that's what they told him to do. And they made him kill women and children. There was like 500 of them. It wasn't like just one or two or three. There was 500 women and children. And like 70-something of those women were pregnant. So they killed the babies too. And that was the first week that my dad was here. And then he still had 13 more months to go after he had to do that. And he had to go through, I don't even know how many villages they dropped him off at, that they had to do the same thing, because that's when, during the war, it turned into basically a genocide, and everything that was out there, they killed it. Men, women, children, babies, dogs, cats, pigs, everything. They just went out there and they killed everything that they came in contact with. I got a ride from my dad and I went back to the state of California. It was Father's Day of 1997. I was coming home, and when I got to the house, I noticed there was a bunch of police cars outside of my house. And I thought maybe somebody had hurt somebody in my family, or maybe I was in trouble or something. I didn't know. So I hurried up and I pulled in the driveway and I asked them what was going on, and they said that they needed to talk to me. So I went and I went to the side with them and I started to talk to them, and they told me that there was some people that were riding some motorcycles and they had found my dad's body out in the middle of the desert in his car, and that he had committed suicide. And it was so hard for me, because all my life my dad was always there. He always tried to help me. He helped take care of me. He helped make sure that I had my prosthetic legs and everything. And just all of a sudden, all at once, all of that was gone.
This war in Vietnam, guess what? It wasn't going like the other wars that the United States had been involved in. They think the idea that, you know, maybe America didn't win like they thought they were going to, or that there was subversive reasons for us getting into the conflict or the war itself, that America mismanaged their military, or they were after natural resources, or they just wanted land close to China. There is so much controversy just around those parameters.
The people actually got to see the war on TV. It was broadcast. They showed all the people that were getting blown up and all the kids that were getting sprayed and all the death and destruction of what the war was actually had going on in it. And once the American people saw how awful war really is, because most of the time in America, because nobody attacks America on their own soil or anything like that.
General, how would you assess yesterday's activities and today's? What is the enemy doing? Are these major attacks or...
This is the main Vietnamese language radio station in Saigon.
661, that order to get the snipers out. When the American people saw this, they started having riots in the street. They started protesting at the government. They started, like, just having all kinds of problems in the United States over it.
So many years after 1975, that it's still in infancy. Like, I don't think historians even know what to write about it. I don't think they know what's real. I don't think they know what's false about it, what's mythological about it, anything. I think at first it came out of the veteran's mouth, my kids are sick, I'm sick, and they said, guess what? You're just a bunch of baby killers. You're just a bunch of whiners. You're a bunch of drug addicts. Now you just want a free handout. That's what they were met with.
Agent Orange was a safe product when it was used in the Vietnam War, and it's a safe product today.
We don't mean to say that there isn't an Agent Orange effect, but at this point in time, we don't seem to see anything that confirms that there's something there specifically.
Just hours before, thousands of Vietnam veterans were supposed to be represented in court against seven chemical companies. There was an out-of-court settlement.
I think they just try to sweep it under the rug so nobody knows, so that people won't be trying to go, well, wait a minute, I have a bad liver, or wait a minute, I have a brother that's missing an arm and we've never had birth defects in our family, or wait a minute, now I know why you don't have any legs and all that. And then for all the people to come together and sue the chemical company, I think that's what their issue is. I think they don't want everybody to know about the Agent Orange, because if everybody knew how awful it was, and that the government, they would have to pay for medical bills and all kinds of stuff, and they don't want to do that, so they try to hide it and pretend like it never happened.
It's just still on the cusp. It's just out on the edge. Nobody will take it and pull it in. Very famous actor in the United States, Tom Hanks, currently doing The 60s. It's a documentary series that's been showing on CNN. I waited on bated breath, you know, he's talking about the 60s and the Vietnam War and showing film and how it affected. I was waiting, come on, nothing. I went to a speech with journalists who were here during the war, who weren't in the military but were journalists, very famous journalists in Pittsburgh a couple months ago. I waited, come on, something, say something. Sorry. It makes me so angry. They just erase our history. They erase it. It's gone. It doesn't exist. They don't care. And that has been what we've heard our entire lives. You're controversialist. You just want controversy. You're just making stuff up. No, it's happened. They talked about everything. They talked about the strife. They talked about this and that and what it was like to be here and how the troops were and what it was like in the... Say something. You come here as a journalist and you stayed in Vietnam. You were able to see both sides of the story. And you've been back to Vietnam. And you talk about it. Say something. You know that the children here are still suffering. You know that the Vietnam vets are suffering. Say something, nobody. You have people who are suffering, who have suffered their entire lives because of decisions people made in an office somewhere. They made the decision to spray this stuff. This is going to be a good idea. We're going to save people. People still today claim Agent Orange saved people. Okay, maybe it did. But those lives were worthwhile, and I don't diminish that at all. But there are millions of us that are suffering because of this chemical.
that these people have taken me in. Like when we went to the Friendship Village and those Vietnamese veterans that came out, they were the NVA. They were the ones that were at war with my dad. And my dad probably shot at some of them, and some of them probably shot at my dad. And when I came face to face with those guys, that was a pretty intense moment because I didn't